Happy Sabbath, everybody. Today's date is January the 7th, 2017. This is our first study in the new year, and it's entitled Sealing, S-E-A-L-I-N-G, Sealing Inkhorn. The marking from the writer's inkhorn has been a point of quizzical deliberation since the promulgation of the Shepherd's Rod message. In this series 36, entitled The Magnified Rod Themes, renewed study into this puzzle has surfaced. Today we shall refine our doctrine. What is the connection between the marking man with the writer's inkhorn and the Lord's publisher of peace, the man with the seal, the Lord's, quote, ready writer, close quote? Such a query has been posed, and we are now about to embark upon the mustard seed's official position. The assumption is that a writer must have the inkhorn. Our study, again, entitled The Sealing Inkhorn, will force us to expand our understanding beyond the simplistic assumptions. Let us begin by reading Ezekiel 9. As we turn to Ezekiel chapter 9, let me just say that when I labeled this series 36, entitled Magnified Rod Themes, in the back of my mind there were several themes that I knew that I would have to touch on. One of the central themes is Ezekiel 9. So, my hand has now been forced to delve into this issue, even though I've sort of been reticent to so do. Let us read verse 1. Quote, "He cried also in mine ears with a loud voice, saying, Cause them that have charge over the city to draw near, even every man with his destroying weapon in his hand." Interrupting the quote. There are people that you not realize that have charge over the church. And these are the people that are called. The mustard seed has no such charge. And it says in verse 2, and I quote, "And behold, six men came from the way of the higher gate, which lieth toward the north, and every man a slaughter weapon in his hand. And one man among them was clothed with linen, with a writer's inkhorn by his side. And they went in and stood beside the brazen altar. And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub, whereupon he was, to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed with linen, which had the writer's inkhorn by his side. And the Lord said unto him, Go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. And to the others he said in mine hearing, Go ye after him through the city and smite, and let not your eye spare, neither have ye pity." Close quote. We see here now that the one man has the writer's inkhorn. He's clothed in linen. But all six are agents of destruction. All six participate in the slaughter of Ezekiel 9. Such a commission is not the mustard seed's calling. And such is not really the focus of the mustard seed's ready writing skills. But the point deserves to be honored. This is a harvesting theme. Now, some people are given the mark, and other people who are not given it are destroyed. Now, we know that the mustard seed's commission has not been to the nominal Seventh-day Adventist church. We sent out a message that indicated that we had the redress and the answer to all of their greatest controversies, and we invited them to take the opportunity to investigate and they refused. So that in itself seems to be a point of distinction between the mustard seed and the man with the writer's inkhorn. Yet and still, you do well to recognize that the harvester here is similar, not the same as the sealer. E.G. White and V.T. Hotev taught us of the symmetry between the mark and the seal. Under their leadership, we understood that the mark was the same as the seal. The mustard seed advent has license to advance the doctrine so that we can have a greater understanding and clear up the confusion that prevails. Let me read you a reference from E.G. White, and I quote, "The true people of God who have the spirit of the word of the Lord and the salvation of souls at heart will ever view sin and its real sinful character." Oh, that's an important point of emphasis, one that we need to bring to the forefront now. Continuing forward in the quote, she says, "These people will ever view sin in its real sinful character. They will always be on the side of faithful and plain dealings with sin, which easily besets the people of God, especially in the closing work for the church, in the sealing time of the 144,000 who are to stand without fault before the throne of God. Will they feel most deeply the wrongs of God's professed people? This is forcibly set forth by the prophet's illustration of the last work under the figure of the men, each having a slaughter weapon in his hand. One man among them was clothed with linen, with a writer's inkhorn by his side. And the Lord said unto him, Go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof." Close quote. E.G. White, Testimonies for the Church, Volume 3, page 266, quoted profusely in the Rod. One of our misconstructions was the concept that the 144,000 are people that are going to be contained within the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Therefore, we consider the seal and the mark to be same action and the same activity. We were wrong in that presumption. The spirit of prophecy born is not to speculate about who's going to be among the 144,000, because when the truth comes, the elect of God will know without a doubt. That's found in 1 Selected Messages, page 174. And now we can know that the 144,000 are not the recipients of this mark. But let me just reach back into the earlier point by saying that the mustard seed advent is a movement of peace. It's not a work of slaughter, disturbance. I, dear Wes, have no experience in such activities. And you would feel that the Lord would call some. You're going to see He has many that excel in that experience. David lets us know. He says in Psalms 37, verse 34, quote, "Wait on the Lord and keep His way, and He shall exalt thee to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, thou shalt see it." Interrupting the quote for comment. Automatically now we understand that David is admonishing us to keep His way. Assuming we have to know His way. We learn His way by the testimony of Jesus. Now, therefore, we could not have really fully embraced this counsel in Psalms 37, verse 34, until we learn the way of the Lord and solidified it in our minds. "Wait on the Lord and keep His way." I continue to quote. "And He shall exalt thee to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, thou shalt see it." the people that are patient, that wait on the Lord, the people which learn the way of the Lord, are going to witness the day when the enemy are cut off. They're going to see it. They're not going to execute it. They're going to see it. I continue to quote. Verse 35. I have seen the wicked in great power and spreading himself like a green bay tree. Yet he passed away, and lo, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found. Mark the perfect man, and behold the upright. For the end of that man is peace, 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 peace. But the transgressors shall be destroyed together. The end of the wicked shall be cut off. Interrupting for clarification, we're told that the perfect man, his end is peace. Then in contradistinction to the peace, he shows the people that are going to be cut off. And consequently, the perfect man is non-participatory by suggestion of the Psalms and the cutting off of the wicked. Continuing in the quote, verse 38. But the transgressors shall be destroyed together. The end of the wicked shall be cut off. But the salvation of the righteous is of the Lord. He is their strength in the time of trouble. And the Lord shall help them and deliver them. Interrupting for clarification. He's going to do what? He's going to help them and he's going to deliver them. It could have said, and they shall help themselves in the Lord. By getting rid of the wicked people in the church. But that's not what the Lord inspired David to say. Finishing the quote. Verse 40. And the Lord shall help them and deliver them. He shall deliver them from the wicked. And save them because they trust in him. Automatically now, by David's profession, the commission to cut off the wicked is placed squarely at the feet of Christ in contradistinction to the mustard seed, the perfect marked man. In fact, we have more. Matthew chapter 10, verse 16. This is Christ giving a command. Remember, our salvation comes by keeping his commands, right? Verse 16. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless, 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 as doves. We could place special emphasis on this instruction here, this commandment today, because we know that the testimony of Jesus expresses the will of the Father and deserves highest authority. Let us read Luke chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. After these things, the Lord appointed other 70 also, and sent them two and two before his face into every city and place, whether he himself would come. Therefore he said unto them, the harvest is truly great, but the laborers are few. Pray therefore the Lord of the harvest that he would send forth laborers into his harvest. Here you have another command. Wonderful thing that we could recognize the commands of the Lord. He gave instructions that transcend all the way to our mission today. He said, pray. Who was he telling to pray? His disciples. What should we pray for? You should pray that the Lord of the harvest will send forth some other people, laborers into the harvest. Consequently, you should pray for harvesters. Isn't that what he says? Quote, pray ye therefore, the Lord of the harvest, that he would send forth laborers into his harvest. Close quote. The mustard seed represents the elder disciple. He has to be in compliance with these instructions as well. Therefore, let us remember that we'll pray that the Lord of the harvest will send forth harvesters. Matthew chapter 13, verse 24 through 30. Quote, "The kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man which sowed good seed in his field." Interrupting for comment. It says, the kingdom of heaven. He's giving you an understanding about how the kingdom of heaven is going to come to fruition. He gives you a metaphor. He says, it's likened unto a man which sowed good seed in his field. Verse 25, continuing in the quote. "But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, then appeared the tares also." And remember what E.G. White says. We read in Testimonies for the Church, Volume 3, page 266. And I interrupt the quote to remind you. She said, "The true people of God, who have the spirit of the work of the Lord and the salvation of souls at heart, will ever view sin in its real sinful character. Therefore, as they witness these tears coming up, that's exactly what they're doing. Well, this is wrong. This is taking us on the wrong path. We're viewing sin in its real sinful character. What should we do, Lord?" Continuing in Matthew chapter 13, verse 26. "But when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, then appeared the tares also. So the servants of the householder came and said unto him, Sir, didst not thou sow good seed in thy field? From whence then hath the tares? And he said unto them, An enemy hath done this. The servant said unto him, Wilt thou then that we go and gather them up? But he said, Nay, lest while ye gather up the tares, ye root up also the wheat with them. Let both go together until the harvest." Aha. This is why you need to pray that the Lord of the harvest will send laborers. "Let both go together until the harvest. And in the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, Gather ye together first the tares, bind them in bundles to burn, but gather the wheat into my barn." Close quote. We have a prophetic rendering of that commission in Ezekiel 9, because the Lord gives the six angels his commission. Now, let me just state here, the six men with the slaughtering weapons, we don't know if that's a literal six number. I believe that it is a literal six number, but they may be commissioners. Each of them may have 1,000 people working under them, if you follow. But the Lord gives the commissioners the assignment, and they are executing the assignment by orchestrating it amongst their people. Similarly, did Nebuchadnezzar commanded all of the wise men of the land be gathered together to be destroyed. He didn't do it himself, but had he been successful in that execution, it would have been his responsibility. The Bible would have said that Nebuchadnezzar slew them. Therefore, let's put that point in the back of our minds, and we could more intelligently assess what's really going on when we study about the marking of Ezekiel 9. Verse 37 of Matthew chapter 13. "And he answered and said unto them, He that soweth the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. The good seed are the children of the kingdom, but the tares are the children of the wicked one. The enemy that sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the world, and the reapers are the angels." Key point of interruption. The harvest is in the end of the world. There's so many backstitches to this study that I have to put special emphasis on things that we're going to relate back to later on, that it's important that you sort of be reminded with greater emphasis about what we're reading. It says, and I quote, "The harvest is the end of the world." Close quote. "And the reapers are the angels." Well, how could they be the angels? Ezekiel says that they're men, right? Continuing in the quote. "As therefore the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so shall be in the end of this world. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them which do iniquity." Now, he doesn't tell you that the Father is going to send forth. He says that the Son of Man an obvious reference to himself. Christ is the one who is going to send forth his angels. Remarkable, isn't it? Christ has angels. He could have said the man. Then we'd have a point of confusion. But by virtue of the fact that he identifies him as the Son of Man, he points to himself as a subordinate of the man. And we've dealt with that study with greater clarity in time past. But let us just know that the Son of Man has angels. He's going to send them forth to gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them which do iniquity. Well, I thought you said it was the Father's kingdom. Well, Christ is the Father's magisterial agent. He establishes the kingdom to be presided over by David under Father's engineering design. Oh, I hope we could touch on that point as we advance. But the disciples, let us understand, in Matthew chapter 13, are commanded to focus on doctrine. That's why it says, let both grow. That's the mustard seed's commission, to let both grow. I'm not helping the tares to grow, although with my advances, they become more terroristic, but I'm helping you to grow. Let both grow until the harvest. Then what happens in the harvest? According to Matthew chapter 13:41, I quote again, the Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them which do iniquity. The Seventh-day Adventist Church is Zion. And the Lord is going to remove from Zion those people that are enmeshed in iniquity, so that he could put the Son of David, the Mount Zion of the Lord, we learned in our last study in Psalm 78, he could put them in charge of a church that has been purified. Then the Father can celebrate Christ's work and Jesus' work and David's work for installing under his domain the kingdom of earth. I'm reading from Psalms 104. It tells us about the Lord's angels. Verse 1 through 4. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, thou art very great. Thou art clothed with honor and majesty. Now we could take the time to show that even though David is calling him Lord here, he's referring to Christ. And David did not know the identity of the Father. Christ represented himself as God Almighty. He had power of attorney to represent himself in that way. Therefore, it says in Matthew chapter 22, in reference to David, what think you of Christ? Whose son is he? David calleth him Lord. Whence then is he his son? Therefore, when we read here in the Psalms 104, verse 1, O Lord my God, he's referring to Christ. Let's quote it again. Psalms 104, verse 1. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, thou art very great. Thou art clothed with honor and majesty, who covers thyself with light as with a garment, who stretcheth out the heavens like a curtain, who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters, who maketh the clouds his chariot, who walketh upon the wings of the wind, who maketh his angel spirits his ministers a flaming fire. David is telling you that Christ, talk about his angels, right? He's telling you the process of angel acquisition. He makes them spirits. Evidently, therefore, they're different than the other angels that we've come to understand, ministering spirits, because these people had to be converted into spirits. Therefore, they were flesh and bone human beings. But in order for them to administer under Christ's behest, they have to be able to have the ability to appear and disappear. The ability to transport themselves the way that angels could so do. Therefore, Christ has a marvelous power that he can convert humans into spirits. Now, we're not teaching the doctrine that you've got a spirit within you, that when you die, he goes off to heaven. No, that's the doctrine of devils. But we're telling you that if the Lord, for example, took Enoch up into heaven, that he was able to convert him into a spirit, the same way that he did with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when they were cast into the fiery furnace. Like that, he was able to preserve and protect them. Send forth his angels. Jude 14. And Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, Behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000s of his saints. Why? To execute judgment upon all, and to convince all that are ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds, which they have ungodly committed, and of all their hard speeches, which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. Close quote. Our point of reference here that we need to garner from this text is they come to execute judgment. Therefore, when you offer the Lord a petition, you could do so in a more educated way when you compel him to send forth laborers into the harvest. Your salvation hinges upon the church being eradicated of sinners. Therefore, you being left behind, you become the Mount Zion of the Lord's glory and his holiness. But I pose the question, some of you may have posed already in your minds, is this confusing in light of John 4? You know what we read in John 4? He that reapeth receiveth wages. One soweth and another reapeth, that the two may rejoice together. Just quoting snippets. If Christ orchestrates the reaping harvest, then how is it the mission of another man, Jacob, can be the reaper? In short, Jacob David is not trained in divine destruction. He feeds. Let us unfold deeper answers to this conundrum as we advance. We talked about the mark. We could talk about the seal now. The seal was described in the testimony of Jesus in John chapter 6, verse 26. Jesus reprimanded the church back in his day after he had fed the 5,000 and he traveled to the other side of the Sea of Tiberias. And they followed after him. He reprimanded them by saying, Verily, verily, I say unto you, ye seek me not because ye saw the miracles, but because ye did eat of the loaves and were filled. Labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you. For him hath God the Father sealed. Consequently, this person is an agent of the Father. The Father seals him. We can only have appreciation for this by discerning the distinction between Jesus, Christ, the Holy Spirit, and Father. Because he could have said, for him will I seal. That would have a completely different meaning. This is the person who the power of the highest sealed. Why does he seal? Verse 44 of John 6. No man can come to me except the Father which hath sent me, draw him. And I will raise him up at the last day. Therefore, in this last day, remember, the harvest is at the end of the world, right? In this last day, Christ raises up this servant because the Father draws the servant to Christ. And therefore, Christ says, I'm going to lift you up. I'll raise him up at the last day. But what about the slaughter of Ezekiel 9? Well, no, I'm going to lift you up above that. That's part of being raised up. You no longer have to take out the trash, so to speak. But more important than that, we see his connection to all the reason why the Father seals him, because he says, it is written in the prophets, and they shall all be taught of God. Every man, therefore, that hath heard and hath learned of the Father cometh unto me. Therefore, this person is sealed for the express purpose in the last day to teach people of the Father. It's the Father's salvation. It's the Father's atonement. You receive salvation while you're alive, because God is a God of the living, not of the dead, by receiving the Father's seal. Jesus presides over the judgment of the dead. And he gives those people access to the kingdom. And Father honors his access. But those people did not have an opportunity to come to the Father. They will in the resurrection. And therefore the Father sealed this person, this antitypical Elijah, this antitypical David, the son of David, so that he can seal the saints. We have a perfect segue now to advance to the text that defines the seal. Correct? That's Revelation. We've studied in the sixth seal. In chapter 6, verse 12, and I quote, "And behold, when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell unto the earth, even as the fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind," etc. Verse 15, and it says, "And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and every free man hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, Fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, from the wrath of the Lamb." But then the text that we want to really address is found in the next chapter. Chapter 7, verse 1. "And after these things I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the winds should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea." Interrupting ourselves here. This person had the seal of the living God. He has to be the same one that is striving to teach people of God. He has to be the one that's commissioned to enlighten, the one whom the Lord said that we should seek after. Because for him hath God the Father sealed. He has been given the seal. And he is defined as another angel. He ascends from the east. And he cries with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, "Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads." And I heard the number of them which were sealed, and they were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. He evidently has this urgency to win or to harvest the 144,000. And therefore, he does not want the destructive judgments to begin on the earth until after they are protected or until after they are sealed. But I like the fact that he is a commissioner. Let us seek to describe more of that as we advance. Now first, let us understand that this kingdom movement, because we're told that the 144,000 are the first fruits, this kingdom movement is God's movement. It comes by virtue of his sealed angel ascending from the east. The Lord says he would raise him up in the last day, and that defines his ascension. Therefore, we have to understand that this kingdom, and this is the point that only mustard seed Adventists can understand, is not a Christ conceptualized theme, not a Jesus conceptualized theme. This is the Father's kingdom. He was the one who came up with the concept of the king. You remember in the Garden of Eden, The Father said, let us make man in our own image and after our likeness, and let him have dominion. It says he created Adam and Eve, and he said, be fruitful and multiply, and their key word, and replenish the earth, and have dominion over everything that moveth on the earth. I'm loosely quoting. From Jump Street, it was Father's concept of the kingdom that it would come 6,000 years later in a time of replenishment. In a time when we could all be taught of God. Or else he would not have given Adam and Eve the commission to replenish. He knew. And Christ may not have known. Because Christ laments with the flood that he regretted ever making man. But the Father did not share that lamentation. The Father joys in our creation because he knew 6,000 years from the beginning that not only will he be glorified, but Christ will be glorified also. And he will have a servant that will be able to rule the planet and that will be able to replenish the planet. Oh, should we give him a slaughtering weapon, Father? No, no. This is a man of peace. This is a man of grace. You can find somebody else to do your dirty work. To underscore this point, let's read Matthew 24, verse 34 through 36. Verily, verily, I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. He's referring to our generation. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. But of that day and hour knoweth no man. No, not the angels of heaven, but the Father only. The Father knew from the beginning how long it would take to create man in his image and after his likeness. So that man would be vested with the authority to even call people forth from the grave. So that he could replenish the earth. People who have suffered oppression and affliction will have their day of vengeance and their day of satisfaction. It's the Father's kingdom. Having said that, we must determine which kingdom advancing agent, Christ, David, or Jesus, orchestrates Ezekiel 9. Abraham by type helps. He is an advocate. He did not execute. Even his servants butchered for him. Remember, we think that we give Abraham credit for preparing the meal for Christ and his three angels. But Abraham really didn't himself do it. He went out and he picked out a calf. He gave it to his servant to slaughter it. And he gave it, I believe it was to Sarah, to dress it and prepare it. You could go back and read the precisions of the of details thereto pertaining, but I think that you'll find that my rendering of it is accurate. So even Abraham didn't have the commission to bludgeon and to butcher. He had servants that would perform that commission for him. And we're told that his seed is going to bless the nations. In fact, we should read that. Verse 17 of Genesis 18, quote, and the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do? Why not, Lord? What is Abraham? What business is it of his? Well, he tells you what business is it of his if you read the next verse, verse 18. Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. The Lord comes and he tells him he's going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Then Abraham begins to show not a zeal for destruction yet. Those folks ain't right. Take it to them, Lord. I've heard some nasty reports. That cannot be the demeanor of the one who's ordained to bless the nation. Abraham said, well, if there are 50 folks, are you going to destroy the whole city? For the sake of the 50, the Lord says no. So they negotiated all the way down to how many people? To 10 people, right? You remember the story, don't you? Verse 32. And he said, Oh, let not the Lord be angry. I will speak yet but this once. So this is the last time. I mean, they're in these negotiations. He says, Lord, you know, don't get upset with me. I'm just being an advocate. These are my people. My seed is going to inherit this planet. So many people are going to come forward in the resurrection. So I'm concerned. Oh, let not the Lord be angry, as I continue in the quote. And I will speak yet but this once. Peradventure, 10 shall be found there. And he said, I will not destroy it for 10's sake. I like to think of the mustard seed forwarding on this negotiation about how punishment is doled out. And we really see that in Revelation chapter 7. He says, hold up. Don't begin to destroy the earth, nor the seed, nor any tree, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. I can envision we come from heaven. We're angels of God. Where do you get the authority to tell us how to do our work? Well, something has transpired here. And the son of Abraham has been now given power with God and with man. He's been given power to negotiate destruction and salvation. This was the blessing that was handed to Jacob, Genesis chapter 32. And he said, thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, for as a prince thou hast power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. And now we understand that his power falls directly under the authority of the highest. He's got power with God and with men. Showing you that that power has never been installed yet, we read the promise as it was iterated through proverbial Peter in Matthew chapter 16, verse 16. And Simon answered and said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said unto him, blessed art thou, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. The Father spoke directly to Peter. He communicated this information to Peter. And I say unto thee, that thou art Peter, and upon this rock will I build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. We know that we could go on to show that Peter is prefigurative of the Son of David as he emerges and is raised up in the last day. But yet and still, he has power with God and with man. And therefore, he's given the commission to command the angels of God. These are Father's angels that you're reading about in Revelation. We spoke of the conundrum trying to connect Ezekiel 9 with John chapter 4, because we saw that Christ was going to orchestrate the harvest. In fact, he's going to send forth his angels, his laborers, into his harvest. And they're going to orchestrate his harvest. Yet and still, our study has shown us clearly that the mustard seed is the harvester. Indeed, this is a conundrum that needs to be clarified. John chapter 4, verse 32, quote, but he said unto them, I have meat to eat that ye know not of. Verse 34, my meat is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. This is Christ's commission. His commission is to finish the Father's work. And he that reapeth receiveth wages and gathereth fruit unto life eternal, that both he that soweth and he that reapeth may rejoice together. Therefore, the reaper is the one who is sent forward to gather the clusters of the earth, the 144,000. His commission is not to mark and to slay in Laodicea. He's not been given commission to slay. Well, then, how does that really address the issue? Because some of the people in the slaughter of Ezekiel 9 are going to receive the mark. Well, we're going to see that those people that receive the mark, that receive salvation, represent the resurrected in the special resurrection who decide to embrace this message. The mustard seed's commission has been over with the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The mustard seed's commission is to call the workers, beginning with the last, right? According to Matthew 20. Therefore, he calls forward all of those that have had participation in the three angels' message, and he instructs them. And their embrace of the message is made manifest by their sighing and decrying against the abominations that are done in the land and in the church. Therefore, if Elder Lober, or if Jones and Wagner, or if some of the other, even more contemporary, if V.T. Hotton, if M.J. Bingham, if these people come forward and they are tepid about the message so that it doesn't convict them to sigh and cry against the abominations, to bewail them, they can't receive the seal. But yet and still, the reaper calls them forward. They could not receive the mark unless they're called forward from the grave in the special resurrection. Do you follow? So now you can see more clearly the fact that there's a distinction between the reaper and Christ. He says in John 5 that those who have done evil unto everlasting damnation and those who have done good to everlasting life in the kingdom. I continue to quote. John chapter 4, verse 36. And he that reapeth receiveth wages and gathereth fruit unto life eternal. Eternal, eternal, eternal. Close quote. We have no inconsistency. The conundrum is answered. For the people to be resurrected represents his gathering. He's empowered by the highest to perform that function. He's the steward of Matthew 20. It's up to them. The call of workers, the resurrected in the special resurrection, it's up to them to decide whether or not they want to embrace the truth. Brother Hotef, E.G. White, they could not have delivered this message to you yesterday. Why? Because this is the message that was conveyed upon the predetermined son of Adam, who was the son of Abraham, who was to be the son of Jacob, the son of David, all the way down to the last day when the Lord raises him up. Revelation chapter 1 makes this point. Verse 1, quote, the revelation of Jesus Christ which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. Do you see the litany of light? The relay of truth. This is the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him. Father gave this information for Jesus to reveal, to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John, who bear record of the word of God, and of the testimony of Jesus Christ, and of all things that he saw. And he says, blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand. This is the blessing of Abraham. We use that term blessing in a way that it was not intended. We want it to say, it's nice that you understand. But he's saying blessed. That means that the Father's relaying to you information that's going to win for you admittance into the kingdom. That's how you're blessed. Not everybody that reads can understand. That's why it says in chapter 3, verse 22 of Revelation, quote, he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. We see in Isaiah 50, verses 2 through 7, that one special individual is ordained to hear and to see. He's the one that is the blessed one who's going to understand. I say that to show that nobody else could have unfolded this information. Any opinion that you had upon it was cogged in murkiness, and you were destined to misunderstand. Revelation chapter 7, again, we see the sealing. We see the one who fills Peter's prophetic shoes, who's been given power with God and with man, making a commission and a command. He doesn't say, please don't hurt. He says, hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. Therefore, we see that these angels are the Father's angels. We made a distinction earlier that Christ is going to send for his angels. Now, the sealing angel would have commission over both Father and Christ's angels, but Christ is going to send forth his angels to conduct the destruction and the slaughter at the appropriate time. He sends forth his Enochians to conduct the slaughter of Ezekiel 9. And that's why Ezekiel describes them as men. Six men with slaughtering weapons. So to answer even further the confusion of the conundrum about the reapers, Christ is the sower, the mustard seed is the reaper. The two have separate and distinct, mutually exclusive identities. Otherwise, they both could not be said to be expected to rejoice together. We see that human agents are ordained to kill sinners in the church. We can now know better, with greater clarity, that they, like Abraham's butcher, have been acclimated or trained in this mission. I might swing and miss. I might not do the job correctly. Don't rely upon me in this. I have no training. They are men with experience in the slaughter of church members. I think of Jehu. He must be one of them. Assuming that he came forward in the resurrection at Calvary, then he'd become the perfect candidate. He slew the entire house of Ahab. 2 Kings chapter 10. Let's read verse 21 of chapter 9 first. And Joram said, make ready, and his chariot was made ready. And Joram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, went out, each in his chariot. And they went out against Jehu, and met him in the portion of Naboth, the Jezreelite. And it came to pass, when Joram saw Jehu, that he said, is it peace, Jehu? And he answered, what peace, so long as the whoredoms of thy mother Jezebel and her witchcraft are so many? You see, Jehu wasn't a man of peace. I got work to do. You can't expect peace until that work is done. Witchcraft prevails. Masonry prevails the land. Chapter 10, verse 11. So Jehu slew all that remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all his great men, and his kinfolks, and his priests, until he left him none remaining. So, Jehu got greater skill than me in that regard. I can envision him being one of the ones that has the bludgeoning slaughter weapon in his hands. You know, there are some people that receive this commission and know how to execute it. Another one would be, who else can you think of? Elijah himself. In fact, I believe that Elijah is the man with the writer's inkhorn. He's an Enochian. He was taken up to heaven, and he's got skill to kill for the name and the honor of the Lord. Nebuchadnezzar. We discussed earlier how he gathered all the false prophets and made a pronouncement of death upon anybody that blasphemes the name of the Lord. He'll have this opportunity. All of these men, in spite of their bloodletting, will be given place in the Davidic kingdom. But David has to build the temple. His hands should not be bloody. And I say that with emphasis because the man with the writer's inkhorn had a slaughtering weapon in his hand. I got my books in one hand, got my Bible in the other. My mission is that of peace. They're commanded to seal those, to put a mark upon the foreheads of all those that sigh and that cry. Right? You have to think about what is it exactly that they're sighing and crying about. I remember when I was just new into the rod message, been an Adventist all my life, we found all type of vacation. Anytime somebody disagreed with E.G. White, we sighed against it. And we made mockery of ministers that ate ice cream and chicken. You see, that's what we sighed and cried against. Now, these are people that have embraced witchcraft. These are the abominations that have to be denounced. These are people that have refused to turn their hearts to the children. These are people who have blasphemed the name of the Lord. This is the abominations that are to be decried. They are those revealed by the mustard seed. Therefore, if there is synergy between the seal and the mark, it's this. The Enochians learn from the mustard seed which abominations to decry, or which abominations that the church is supposed to decry. Some abominations are now more carefully defined. Let us read Revelation chapter 13, verse 4. And they worshiped the dragon which gave power to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast who was able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. Now, these blasphemies were installed by the papacy. Clemency was given to the church until the truth about God is revealed. And when the truth about God is revealed and the people in the church refuse to embrace it, they fall under the papal blasphemous advocacy. They reject the identity of Jesus, the identity of Christ, and the identity of Father. They refuse to be taught of God. Isaiah 28, that shows you some of their offenses. Verse 7, but they also have erred through wine and through strong drink, are out of the way. The priests and the prophets have erred through strong drink. They are swallowed up with wine. They are out of the way through strong drinks. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. For all tables are full of vomit and filthiness, so that there is no place clean. Whom shall he teach knowledge? And whom shall he make to understand doctrine? Them that are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breast. But the word of the Lord, verse 13, was unto them precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little and there a little, that they might go and fall backward and be broken and snared and taken. This wine and this vomit and this filthiness are false doctrines that have enveloped the church. We could spend a lot more time dealing with some of the abominations, but the mustard seed has identified these abominations. And one of them, for example, is the elevation of the spirit of prophecy over the testimony of Jesus. That's an abomination. It's a strike directly at the highest, the power of the highest. Another is a refusal to turn their hearts towards the children, as the Elijah message compels them to so do. Neither V.T. Hotep nor E.G. White could define for Enochians these themes. They're only now being revealed. That's why the Bible says they should all be taught of God. But advancing forward, let us pose one final question. It'll bring our study to a close. How do the Enochians know the people whom to mark? But let's explore from another dimension. We know, for example, that they embrace the message of the mustard seed, and it defines for them righteousness. Therefore, at least these six men with slaughtering weapons have acuity in the mustard seed, allowing them to command those that work under them to orchestrate this cataclysmic devastation. But it's as a result of what we learn in Malachi chapter 3, verse 8. Will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. Are we talking about you, Christ, or are we talking about God? Both, because I'm sent here to finish his work. Well, how in the world can a man rob God? A man robs God by trying to forestall his zeal to win salvation for the world. Continuing to quote, will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation. So what is their curse? They're not blessed, are they? They are denied kingdom entry. But this is the text that I want your focus. It'll help us to close the study. Bring ye all the tithe into the storehouse, that there may be meat in my house. Whose house is it? Not God's house. Remember, he says, will a man rob God? But you've robbed me. Showing there's a distinction between him and the highest, the Father. But he implores you not to rob him by bringing all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house. And prove me now herewith, said the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, there shall not be room enough to receive it. I want to remind you that there's a distinction between the storehouse and the house. Christ implored them to bring their tithe to the storehouse. Why not bring their tithe to the house? Isn't that the simplest thing to do? Because you cannot take your tithe to Christ's house. His servant abides in the storehouse. He produces the literature that's going to win salvation to the world. He produces the fountain. And as a result, there is substance for the Enochians to consume so that they can learn the sigh and cry and to discern who's obedient to the message by the message in the storehouse defining for them what sins they should sigh and decry. Why does Christ have his own house? We're doing so good with time that maybe I should throw that question to the floor. No, I think not. But just ponder upon it for a second. Father and Christ are one. Why do they have to have, as they would say when we were young, separate cribs, so to speak? Separate houses. Remember we read that it was Christ's commission to do the will of the Father. It was his responsibility to build the kingdom for the Father. This is what his work was to do. He has a separate house that went from separate angels in our solar system so that he could assist in the building up of the kingdom and allow for the reaper to have his opportunity to win for Father billions of living souls that are going to have life everlasting. And in that way, our house becomes a palace in Father's house. John chapter 14, verse 2. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. Christ left so that he could include your planet amongst the august assembly that are now relocated in Father's house. It's not that Father has many literal buildings. Some people say he's got a large apartment building. That's not what he's intending to say. He says that the whole universe abides under the Father's domain. They have legal representatives. They have sons of God controlling each of their planets. Those are his many mansions. All the people that abide on those planets give obeisance and recognition and praise and honor to the Father and to Christ and to Jesus. He needs to include planet Earth into that house. And so long as the church and so long as the Vidya is at war with this message, they are seeking to rob God. They are seeking to preclude him from adding planet Earth to his glorious house collection. And I say glorious house collection because this is the house that glorifies Christ and glorifies the Father. This is the reason why I said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. It's going to take 6,000 years. Don't tell anybody. But at the end of it, we're all going to rejoice and we're all going to be happy because the universe is going to understand what happens when you step aside from Christ and follow your own whim. Look at what happened on planet Earth. Look how low and degraded they become. 33rd degree human sacrificers. Doctrine worshippers of devils. The child abductors. All of these other offenses. The Jehu couldn't stand. All this witchcraft. They debased themselves even unto hell. So the other mansions are watching. Oh, I'm sure glad that we trusted in Christ. And Father is honored because his appointment of Christ over Lucifer is vindicated. Because Christ does eternally the will of the Father. Therefore, let us rejoice in our inclusion in that house as we celebrate our sealing acorn message. And with that, I bring the study to a close.